Thanks very much. That was a wonderful introduction, Bob. And thank you all for coming this afternoon. I'm really delighted and honored to be here today. I usually say that every time I speak, but I really mean that from the heart. As I told Bob, this is my favorite place in the world to do research. The material is incredible, not surprisingly. The people are wonderful, from the chief archivist on down, and I always feel like I'm home. The research I did in the FDR archives was essential for citizens of London. Okay. It was here that I found much, if not most, of the material about John Gilbert Wynep, who is one of the three main characters in the book I've written, as Bob mentioned, and actually, to be really honest, the main character in my view. I'm very sorry that Rivington Wynep, his son, died so recently. I was looking forward to seeing him here. He was a real gentleman, and he helped me greatly in doing this book. I discovered Gil Wynep a few years ago while doing research for another book project. I was astonished by what I found out about this man. The most important discovery for me being the key role he played in creating the wartime alliance between the United States and Great Britain, and then keeping it alive once it was born. One of the main reasons I wrote Citizens of London was to bring him to greater public attention and to give him the credit he so richly deserves. It's extraordinary that so few people in this country know anything about him and the significant contributions he made to American history. I found out just how unknown he was last year when Citizens of London came out. And I was on Morning Edition, NPR's show, Morning Edition, and was interviewed by Robert Siegel, who is one of the hosts of Morning Edition. And before we started taping the interview, he said, "I just want you to know that I'm only going to talk in this interview about one person, and that is John Gilbert Wynep." He said, "because I have never heard of him." And I was so amazed, he went on to say, that I had never heard of him, that he conducted an informal poll of the people that he had interviewed the previous week on the show to see if anybody else had heard of him. People like David Brooks, the columnist for the New York Times, and E.J. Dionne, who's a columnist for the Washington Post. And nobody, not one person that he talked to, had ever heard of John Gilbert Wynep either. So before I talk about him and tell you a little bit more about him, I'd like to talk about the overall theme of Citizens of London. In September of 1943, right in the middle of World War II, Winston Churchill made this remark: "If we are together, nothing is impossible. If we are divided, all will fail." What he was referring to was the wartime partnership between the United States and Great Britain. That alliance has come to be known as the special relationship that helped win the war, preserve democracy, and save the world. As the years have passed, its creation has seemed almost preordained. First, you had Churchill rousing his country to stand alone against Hitler in 1940. And then Franklin Roosevelt and the Americans riding to the rescue of Churchill and the British. In fact, it was far from certain until Pearl Harbor that the alliance was actually going to happen. And once it did, it was a fragile and tension-filled partnership from the moment of its birth. Creating it and then keeping it alive was not an easy task, to put it mildly. In Citizens of London, I take a behind-the-scenes look at the alliance from the perspective of three Americans who played vital roles in creating it and then helping to keep it going: Edward R. Murrow, Averell Harriman, and John Gilbert Wynep. Now, Ed Murrow and Averell Harriman are very well known. Murrow, the legendary CBS correspondent who became a household name in the United States when he reported from the rooftops of London during the Battle of Britain and the Blitz. And Harriman, the ambitious, hard-driving, multimillionaire businessman who was sent to London in March 1941 to oversee Lend-Lease aid for Britain. Then there's Gil Wynep, as I've said, almost totally forgotten in the United States. But in many ways, he was the most important of the three. He was the U.S. ambassador to Britain from 1941 to 1946, replacing Joseph Kennedy. Not exactly a hard act to follow. Joe Kennedy went back to the United States in October of 1940 at the height of the Blitz, declaring, "England is gone, and I'm for appeasement 1,000%. Gil Winant was the absolute opposite of Joseph Kennedy. He grew up on Manhattan's East Side, a shy, unassuming boy who loved to read, especially about his hero, Abraham Lincoln. He was sent to prep school at St. Paul's in Concord, New Hampshire, and he fell in love with both the school and the state. He once told a reporter that the hills overlooking St. Paul's came to mean more to him than any other place on earth. He felt at home there. He cared so deeply about this school that after attending Princeton, he came back to teach history there. His students worshipped him. When World War I broke out, he became a pilot in the new U.S. Aviation Corps, flying in combat in France. When it was over, he returned to New Hampshire and resumed his fledgling career in politics. Before he had gone to fight, he had been elected to the New Hampshire House of Representatives as a Republican. And after he came back in 1920, he was elected to the state Senate. Then in 1924, he ran for governor. He was 35 years old. Very few people thought he had a chance. He was a liberal, an intellectual, a former New Yorker, and a terrible speaker to boot. And when I say terrible, I mean terrible. He would get up in front of an audience, and sometimes it would take him what seemed like an eternity just to get a word out. It was as agonizing for the people who were listening to him or hoping to listen to him as it was for him. Someone I interviewed in New Hampshire said that, quote, people in the audience wanted to help him, to shout out the word he was searching for. After one of his campaign speeches in 1924, a woman turned to the person sitting next to her and said, "It's too bad. Such a nice boy, and so badly shell-shocked during the war." But curiously enough, Gil Winant's halting, stammering way of speaking helped win him support in his campaigning around the state. The voters, I think, found him a welcome contrast to the glib politicians they usually encountered. And as awkward as his speeches were, they conveyed warmth and sincerity and gave his listeners the sense of being taken into his confidence. The New York Times once wrote that Winant's audiences begin by feeling sorry for him. They end by standing in the aisle and cheering him. Winant surprised everyone in that campaign, first defeating his Republican primary opponent and then the incumbent Democrat. He was elected to three terms in all, which at that time was a record. He was a man well ahead of his time, showing a passion for economic justice and social change that at least equaled and perhaps even surpassed that of FDR, who was then the governor of New York. Even though he was a Republican, Winant was a strong supporter of Roosevelt and the New Deal. In 1935, FDR named him to head the three-man board that would administer the new Social Security law that had just been passed by Congress. There had been tremendous opposition from Republicans to this unprecedented new program, and the president wanted a prominent Republican to be in charge. By all counts, he was a terrible administrator, the despair of his staff and other board members for his inefficiency and lateness. His desk was piled high with letters awaiting his signature, the room outside his office always crammed with people waiting to see him. His filing system consisted of stuffing important papers in his pockets. But even Winant's severest critics acknowledged that he was an extraordinary leader, a visionary with the ability to inspire. Frank Bain, who was the first executive director of Social Security, said this about him. He was, beyond any shadow of a doubt, one of the great characters in American public life during the past 20 years. Few people have made as significant an impression upon government as it should be, as did Governor Winant.
In 1936, Gil Winans sacrificed his political career because of his support for FDR and Social Security. The Republicans were still intent on killing the program, and in the 1936 presidential campaign, the GOP candidate Alf Landon made Social Security a key campaign issue, vowing to repeal it if elected. As a Republican, Winant decided he could not remain silent about this. He decided he had to resign from the Social Security Board and speak out against Landon. Most of his friends and associates, including Roosevelt, tried to talk him out of it, saying it would be political suicide, that he would be wrecking his career. But he was adamant. He went all around the country making speeches in support of Social Security. And 2 days before the election, he gave a national radio broadcast endorsing Roosevelt for re-election. And everybody was right. His political career as a Republican was indeed over. A friend of his wrote him afterwards that what he did proved, in the friend's words, that at least one man in high office possesses genuine convictions and the courage to stand by them, come what might. I realize that many will call what you did a hopelessly idealistic move and call it that with a sneer. But idealism is one quality this disordered world needs desperately. Shortly after that, Winant became director of the International Labor Organization in Geneva, and then, in 1941, FDR named him ambassador to Great Britain. All three of the men I write about in this book, Winant, Murrow, and Harriman, were key participants in the debate in America in 1940 and 1941 over whether Britain should, in fact, be saved. It was hardly an academic discussion. Throughout that time, 1940 and especially 1941, the British were holding on only by the skin of their teeth. They were, in fact, very close to being defeated by Germany. German submarines were strangling British supply lines, and starvation for Britain's civilians loomed as a distinct possibility. German bombers had already killed tens of thousands of Britons in their raids on London and other British cities. As a matter of fact, not until 1942 were more British soldiers killed than British civilians. The British armed forces lacked adequate arms and ammunition and were on the defensive everywhere. The only hope for the British was American aid, but that aid was very, very skimpy and continued to be so until well after Pearl Harbor. One reason for that was that American industry was strenuously resisting converting to wartime production. The U.S. was not at war yet. The economy was finally bouncing back after the Great Depression. And companies were intent, not surprisingly, on making as much in profits as they could. There was also still a lot of isolationism in the U.S. at that point, and a fair amount of anti-British feeling. Many in Washington and elsewhere had already written Britain off. How in the world could this tiny little island stand up and defeat this humongous German force? The president was clearly not one of those naysayers. He very much wanted to save England, but he was also very cautious. He did not want to go to war if he could do anything at all to prevent that from happening. I should also point out that at this point, Roosevelt and Churchill were highly skeptical, even suspicious of each other. The famous friendship that developed between the two later in the war was nowhere on the horizon at that point. It's common wisdom now that the success of the Anglo-American alliance was in large part due to the close collaboration of those two. And of course, it was vitally important. But equally important, in my view, was the work of many others, prominently including Winant, Harriman, and Murrow, in laying the groundwork for the partnership and then keeping it alive once it was born. Throughout 1940 and 1941, Murrow championed the British cause in his broadcasts to the American people. Harriman and Winant, meanwhile, who were sent to London as Roosevelt's eyes and ears, made clear to the president and his administration that they thought Britain would hold out and that America must do all it could to help the British and Churchill. If we failed to do that, they said, Britain would fall, and the U.S. would be left to face Germany alone. Churchill knew how important these Americans were to his country's survival, and he pursued them as relentlessly as he would later pursue Roosevelt. He had an open-door policy where Murrow was concerned, and would often invite him in for drinks at 10 Downing Street. Miss Janet Murrow, Murrow's wife, and Clementine Churchill became very close friends. They worked together in an organization called Bundles for Britain. And Janet would often have lunch with Clementine Churchill at Downing Street. And whenever Murrow would drop by to pick her up, and whenever he did, Churchill would come out of his study and wave him in and always say, Mr. Murrow, do you have time for several whiskeys? And, of course, Murrow always did. But Churchill was even closer to Wynant and to Harriman. He made both of them part of his inner circle, giving them unprecedented access not only to himself, but to members of his government as well. And this is what's really interesting. He also pulled them into his own personal family life. Indeed, Wynant and Harriman were really de facto members of Churchill's family. They spent many, if not most, weekends with the Churchills at Chequers, which is the Prime Minister's country house, official country house, and at Ditchley, another country estate that Churchill frequently visited during the war. They became so close to the Churchill family, in fact, that all of them had romantic relationships with members of that family. Murrow and Harriman with Pamela Churchill, Winston Churchill's daughter-in-law, not at the same time, I hasten to add. And Gil Wynant was involved with Sarah Churchill, who was the Prime Minister's middle daughter, his favorite daughter. The whereabouts of these three men on the night of Pearl Harbor gives you some idea of their importance to both countries. Wynant and Harriman were both with Churchill at Chequers that night, while Murrow was at the White House with Roosevelt. As soon as they heard the news, all three of them knew the long fight was over. America was now in the war. But another struggle began almost immediately, the struggle to keep this new alliance alive. It was most definitely not an easy thing to do. There were a lot of strains, a lot of tension, a lot of rivalry and prejudices between the two countries, from the top civilian and military leaders, including Roosevelt and Churchill, right down to ordinary civilians. The U.S. and Britain may have shared a common language, a common love of freedom, but there was a tremendous amount of ignorance and misunderstanding between each other about each other's history and about each other's military and political situations. The British had a bad habit of condescending to the Americans, treating them like misbehaving colonists rather than independent allies. The Americans, not surprisingly, were very resentful, thinking that the British had not exactly distinguished themselves on the battlefield up to that point. And who were they to tell us how to run the war, especially when we were coming to rescue them? Here again, Wynant, Murrow, and Harriman stepped in. The ambassador and Lend-Lease representative continued to play important roles as mediators between Churchill and Roosevelt, as well as smoothing the way between the two countries' other top military and government figures. At the same time, Wynant and Murrow devoted much of their energy to explaining each nation to the other citizens. Murrow did so through his broadcasts, while Wynant, always a teacher, spent a great deal of time educating the British about the United States and its people, and educating American troops coming to Britain about their hosts. After the war, the Times of London would call Wynant the adhesive, the glue, that helped hold the wartime partnership together. There are so many things that are compelling about him during this time, but what stands out for me was his extraordinary relationship with the British people. From the day he arrived in Britain in March 1941, which was the worst time of the war for the British, he made very clear that unlike his predecessor, Joe Kennedy, he was there to stay. The first words he spoke after stepping off his plane were, "There's no place I'd rather be at this time than in England." During the heaviest raids of the Blitz, he would walk the streets of London while the bombs were still falling and ask everyone he met what he could do to help. The British people loved him. For many of them, his warmth, his compassion, his kindness, his determination to stand with them and share their dangers was the first tangible sign that Americans did indeed care about what happened to them and their country. He showed them the best side of America. I quote an American GI from New York in the book who said that virtually every British civilian he met told him how much they admired Wynant and how, in his words, this caring and courageous envoy had strengthened their will and determination to fight Hitler. When he left London after the war, the outpouring of love and gratitude was nothing short of astonishing. Not surprisingly, Winston Churchill probably summed up those feelings best. At a farewell dinner, the former Prime Minister, with great emotion, said this: "There was no one who ever had a more momentous mission than Mr. Wynant. There was no one who came closer to the heart of Britain. There was no one who, while upholding in the strictest manner the interests and rights of his own country, made us feel he was a true, faithful, and unyielding friend. He is a friend of Britain. He is more. He is a friend of justice, freedom, and truth. He has been an inspiration." John Gilbert Wynant had a very sad end. At the end of the war, he was very depressed and very lonely. His relationship with Sarah Churchill had ended badly. His whole life had been bound up with Roosevelt, and when FDR died, there was nothing left for him. The Truman administration really didn't want to have anything to do with him, thinking of him as this dreamy idealist, whereas the Cold War had just started and they were in their tough mode. They didn't want any idealists around. Less than 2 years after the war, he killed himself. The shock and grief in Britain over his death was extraordinary. The Manchester Guardian wrote, "It is a terrible thing to consider about our post-war world that John Gilbert Wynant could no longer bear to live in it." I think his suicide has had a lot to do with the fact that he has been almost totally forgotten in America. And one of the reasons I've tried to bring him to public attention is because I think we can learn a lot from him and his idealism, his caring about others. Winston Churchill was absolutely right about him. He was and continues to be an inspiration in so many ways. An inspiration in how he represented the best side of America to England. An inspiration in how he pressed so hard for social justice and the creation of a better life for men and women all over the world. And above all, an inspiration in his determination to persuade the nations of the world, in his words, to concentrate on the things that unite humanity rather than on the things that divide it. Thank you very much. And I'd be very happy to answer any questions you might have about Wynant or anybody else, Churchill, Roosevelt. Yeah. No questions?
Was Stalin ever involved in any of his relations?
I'm sorry?
Stalin from Russia. Was he ever involved in any of his work?
Was Wynant involved? Was Stalin involved in whose work? I'm sorry. I can't hear the question very well.
Was Stalin involved in any of the relations with these gentlemen?
Well, he was involved very closely with Harriman, not with Wynant or Murrow. Harriman managed to make himself kind of the emissary between Churchill and Roosevelt and Stalin. And he first went to the Soviet Union in right after the Atlantic Conference between Churchill and Roosevelt to help to figure out how much aid both Britain and the U.S. were going to give to Russia.
And as I said, he managed to kind of create a special role for himself as an emissary between the two Western leaders and Stalin. And in that regard, he did very well. He was considered regarded very highly by all sides. And then in 1943, Roosevelt decided to make him the U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union, which he did reluctantly, realizing that as ambassador he was not going to have the influence that he had had before, which in fact proved to be true. And once he had been very pro, I won't say pro-Soviet, but he certainly had been pushing very, very hard for the U.S. to give as much aid to the Soviet Union with no questions asked, with no quid pro quo. But once he got over to the Soviet Union and actually was living there, he became much more critical of Stalin and the Soviets, and in fact became pretty much of a hawk by the end of the war, saying basically that we have to stand up to the Soviets. So there was a tremendous change in his attitude toward the Soviet Union over that time. Yes.
Hi, I very much enjoyed your talk. Could you say something about Wynette's relationship, and actually all three of the gentlemen's relationships with Anthony Eden?
Yes. Wynette by far had the closest relationship. Wynette and Anthony Eden became extremely close friends. More so, I mean, it was not a diplomatic friendship at all. They became very, very close personal friends. And in fact, Wynette would go to the Foreign Office virtually every day to talk to Eden. And they worked out a situation, an arrangement, which is really unusual, especially for the British Foreign Office, which was they didn't keep track. They kept no notes of their meetings. There was no bureaucracy involved, which is very unusual. They trusted each other, incredibly, so much so, and became such close friends that Eden would take Wynette home with him on the weekends to his country house. And Eden was a huge gardener. He loved to garden. That was his favorite kind of avocation. And so the two of them would have all their, huge mounds of official papers that they had to get through over the weekend. And they would be working on them. And then they would take breaks. And as Wynette explains in his autobiography, their breaks consisted of going out to the garden and weed. They would weed rows. And they'd get to the end of a row, and then they'd go back to what they considered their drudgery, the work, and go through their papers some more, and then they would take a break to weed. But the friendship was extremely intimate, and when Wynette left, Eden gave an incredibly emotional speech, and at the same dinner that Churchill gave his speech that I read to you, or gave you a little bit of, but Eden's was really from the heart. I mean, he called him perhaps his closest friend, and I'm not going to be able to do it justice, but he said something to the effect, there has never been a fair man that walked the face of the earth than John Gilbert Wynette. And when Wynette killed himself, Eden was distraught. He was really upset. And Gil Wynette's son, Rivington, who Bob mentioned, just died a couple of weeks ago. Rivington was then a student at Oxford, and when Eden found out that his father had killed himself, he immediately went and got Rivington out of Oxford and took him to his home, where he kept him for the next several weeks. And Rivington told me a couple of years ago how deeply that moved him, that he was so incredibly kind at this incredibly traumatic time. And they remained, Rivington remained close to the Eden family from then on. Anthony Eden, I know, knew Harriman and knew Murrow, but I don't think there was any close relationship, but there certainly was one between him and John Gilbert Wynette. They were very similar in many ways, I think.
Lynn London was almost a character in and of itself.
Yeah. I didn't talk about that in this speech, but
that was another main reason. I wanted to do a book that included John Gilbert Wyman, and I also wanted to do a book that had London, wartime London, as a main character, a major character. I had written, actually, as Bob said, I've written 5 books. This is my 5th book, and 4 of the 5 have touched on London and Britain during World War II. And it was such an extraordinary city. I wanted to write something about it because I didn't think most of the books that I've read really capture that, and I'm not sure mine does, but I really tried to. It was one person called it, one historian called it the Paris of World War II. It was the command center for the Allied invasion of Europe. That's where it was planned. That's where all this 1.5 million American troops came to Britain, from 1943 to 1944. Can you imagine? I mean, this very small island the size of Georgia had 1.5 million young American men descend on it. And, of course, most of them were not stationed in London. They were outside, but they came to London for their R&R. And it wasn't just Americans. London was really the capital of occupied Europe during the war, and the world, for that matter. So you had Poles, Czechs, Norwegians, South Africans, Australians, Canadians. You know, it just seemed like everybody was there. And it was a very kind of exciting city romantically. I talked about the fact that these three men had affairs with members of Churchill's family, but that happened a lot, not with members of Churchill's family, but I mean, people. There was a real carpe diem mentality in London during that time. It was, you know, live for the day because tomorrow you may die. And the bombs were still falling. They had the first Blitz had stopped really in May 1941, just before Hitler invaded Russia. But then the Germans started bombing again in 1944 and throughout 1945 with the buzz bombs. And so there was real danger in living there. The chances are you were going to survive, but there was danger. So people just had a really good time while they could. One of my favorite quotes from the book, which I use as an epigraph in the beginning, comes from Pamela Churchill Harriman. She eventually did marry Averell Harriman many years later, who said, "It was a terrible war, but if you were the right age and in the right place, it was spectacular." And for her and for many other people, it was spectacular. But at the same time, there was another London. I've been talking about the romantic city. It wasn't really romantic for most Londoners. But that other London was a city in which people, the ordinary citizens of London, got up day after day and went about their lives and showed great courage and resolution and bravery throughout this. I mean, they were not going to let Hitler defeat them. And we're talking about, I mean, they got a lot of their inspiration from Winston Churchill, obviously, from those wonderful defiant speeches that he made. But it also came from the heart of the British people. They just were not going to let that happen. And the Americans who went over there were extraordinarily impressed and really inspired by the British people, virtually all of them, certainly the American correspondents who went there, Murrow being one of the major ones. I mean, Murrow had spent from 1930, he first went to England in 1937, and he left in 1946, so he was there almost 9 years. And I don't think he ever got over being in London. That, to him, was the key moment of his life. And he kept telling friends when he came back to America, where he was pretty famous when he was in London, but when he came back, he was even more famous, and he became rich. But I don't think he ever... I mean, England was his real home. And he told friends in New York that he had left all his youth and much of his heart in England. And until the day he died, I think he felt more at home and more comfortable in England and in London than he did in the United States. And that was true for a lot of Americans. I end my book with a broadcast that Eric Severide, another CBS correspondent who was there during the war, gave right before he left for America. He was transferred to Washington in October 1941. He had come only 5 months before to London. He had been based in Paris right before it fell to the Germans in June 1941, and he had left just before the Germans marched in. And when he came to London, he was pretty much of an Anglophobe. He was very anti-British. He, like many Americans, he thought the British were patronizing, condescending. They didn't like Americans. So he was there only for about 4-5 months. But those were that period was the Battle of Britain and the Blitz. And by the time he left, he had become, a member of that community. He loved the British, and he loved what they were doing. And in this broadcast, before he left, he compared his time in London with his time in Paris. And he compared London with Paris before the fall, or when it fell. And he said that Paris was like a beautiful woman in a coma, not knowing what had happened to her, not really caring. And then he talked about London, which got up every morning, as he said, with stubborn dignity, ready to go on, regardless of how battered it had been the night before. And throughout this broadcast, he was trying to hold his voice really steady, trying to be very unemotional, as they were supposed to be. Radio correspondents were not supposed to show their emotion on the air, but he lost it at the end. And he ended the broadcast by saying, in years to come, when this war is over, there will be those who say, I was a soldier, I was a sailor, or I was a pilot. And then there will be those who say, with equal pride, I was a citizen of London. And that, to me, that just sums up what this book is about. And that's why I insisted that its title be Citizens of London, something that Random House, my publisher, nobody will know what Citizens of London means. And I said, no, it has to be called Citizens of London, and they finally gave in. The question was, can I talk a little bit more about Averell Harriman and his activities during this period? Sure. He had not been a government official when he was sent over to London. He had been and was the president of Union Pacific Railroad, the company that his father, E.H. Harriman, had founded. And for those of you who have ever seen Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, this is one of my favorite movies, E.H. Harriman is referred to a lot in that movie because his trains are the ones that the two outlaws constantly are robbing. And he's the one that sends the Pinkertons, whoever, after them. So Averell Harriman really lived in his father's shadow, and he very much wanted to be a big deal in the New Deal in Roosevelt's administration, but Roosevelt really didn't have much to do with him. Harriman came from a similar background in a sense. He grew up in the Hudson Valley. That's where his father had a big estate, not too far from here. But the Roosevelts were patrician Hudson Valley patricians. Harriman was nouveau riche, and he was considered a robber baron. And so Roosevelt didn't really have much to do with Averell Harriman. But Averell Harriman was a really close friend of Harry Hopkins, Roosevelt's top aide. And Hopkins helped get him the job of Lend-Lease Administrator to Britain. And Harriman, being very ambitious and thought that this is the way he was going to find power and influence, and in fact, he did. He did it by becoming, interestingly, close to Churchill rather than to Roosevelt, and that closeness to Churchill helped get him close to Roosevelt. And as I said, that he saw this opening for him as kind of an emissary to Stalin from both Roosevelt and Churchill, and he took great advantage of that and then rose
to become ambassador to the Soviet Union, and that helped him become the uber diplomat that he is remembered as, you know, as this elder statesman, which he became. But he had none of that background when he first started. He did it a lot, you know, on his own.
What was the process of developing the invasion of Normandy?
The process of developing the book, we could spend a couple of hours on that. I didn't really do all that much research on that. It was very interesting, though, in when you talk about the Anglo-American cooperation, if that's what you're referring to. There were a lot of differences of opinion between the English and the Americans. First of all, about whether or not there should be an invasion, a cross-channel invasion. The British, having lost so many people in World War I and not really having a very big army, were more inclined to kind of, you know, go around the outskirts of Europe and take bites from Germany rather than to head straight on, which was not the American way of doing things at all. I mean, General Marshall and the other American military leaders wanted to just do a cross-channel invasion. The earlier, the better. And so there was great back and forth, tug of war back and forth about that issue. And then also, once that was settled, you know, how they were going to do it, etc. And from my research, and as I said, this is not a major part of the book. It's really one chapter in the book. The guy who deserves so much credit in bringing this off is Dwight D. Eisenhower. And getting these, he once compared the British and American generals and those below them as cats and dogs, literally fighting. And he was the one who had to keep that all together. And he went through hell to do that, just hell. I had no idea before I started research how difficult it was for him to do it with the backbiting and the criticism that was going on both sides, but a lot of it from his own generals. You know, his closest friends, George Patton and Mark Clark, two major figures, were constantly sniping at him, backbiting, complaining, saying, at one point, Patton wrote in his diary that Eisenhower was a Benedict Arnold for being so nice to the British. But Eisenhower was determined that this was a partnership and that he was not going to slight the British and he wasn't going to slight the Americans, that they had to work together. And he told his subordinates over and over and over again that this is a partnership, this is the way we're going to win the war. If it's not a partnership, we're going to lose. And if you don't believe in this, you're going to go home. But the poor man faced problems in that regard throughout the war, from the time he came to Britain in 1941 to the time he left in 1945. He had a really difficult assignment. And I think, well, he's gotten, obviously, a lot of credit, but the credit for keeping that alliance, the military alliance, together, he deserves above all, I think.
Yes, hello. Should I go first, or should I wait for
someone? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I'm sorry, okay. Yeah.
Yes, and I believe in order to write a nonfiction, you need access to the two facts. Otherwise, it's someone's opinion on what happened in World War II, or you might think it was actual accurate or not accurate. Now, in America, we have the Freedom of Information Act, and I think you have to wait 50 years after World War II before you can find out some of the nitty-gritty details of what happened in the 40s. Two questions. Do you know if there was a Freedom of Information Act in Great Britain? Do you have to be a British citizen, to access their classified or declassified information, and how many years do they hold that information? I'm thinking about today as well as 1943.
I'm not exactly sure of the exact answer to that, but I do know that the British are, it's far more difficult to get hold of information, certain information. There's still information from World War II that is classified that you can't get a hold of. They have an Official Secrets Act, and they're much stricter about classifying. I mean, we have that too, obviously, but it's much harder in many cases to get information about certain things. For example, SIS, MI6, you know, the intelligence services, much of the information is gone, either gone or you can't get access to it. And I really don't know the ins and outs, but I know that many British historians, or any historian who's writing about British subjects, wartime subjects, it can be very frustrating because you just can't get answers. Yes, ma'am.
You mentioned at the start of your book that the King of England actually goes to Paddington Station to meet Ambassador Wynette as when he arrives. Was there any further, other than formal, interaction between the royal family and the ambassador?
Did everybody hear the question? The King of England did go to Windsor State. The day that Wynette arrived in America, in March 1941, King George, of the King's speech fame, went to Windsor Station to greet him personally, which was unprecedented. The King of England the monarch had never ever done that for a foreign ambassador. And to answer your question, yes, there was a continuing relationship between Wynette and the King and Queen, so much so that at the end of the war, after the war, Wynette was given what's called the Order of Merit, which is one of the top honors awarded to to anybody. And the reason why it's such an amazing honor is because the king decides who gets it. And the Order of Merit is the only decoration that Winston Churchill would accept after the war. He would not take a dukedom, or anything. But he did accept the Order of Merit from the king. And George VI decided to give one to Wynette. And in true Wynette fashion, they had a ceremony, and Wynette came to Buckingham Palace, and the king, the box was open with the award, with the decoration, and Wynette closed it and put it in his pocket. And the king says, don't you want to look at it? And so he took it out and looked at it. And the queen, Queen Elizabeth, the queen mother, said, "You above all deserve this." So there was a I wouldn't say it's a close relationship, but certainly the ambassador and the king had a good relationship throughout the war.
Yes, I've enjoyed your talk very much. I'm English, and with regard to the gentleman's question in the front, my father was with the Enigma code-breaking firm in the Second World War, and as far as I knew, all through the war and afterwards, he was in the Royal Air Force. I only learned in 1976, I think it was, that he was in the Navy because he had been taken to work on the code breaking. He had to sign a 25-year secrecy clause, and he had to sign a 50-year. And as he said, he was a small cog in a big wheel, but they had to sign the clauses, and he died before the 50 years, so there's a lot that we never learned from him.
But you did know while he was alive, he did tell you the truth of...
He told us that he worked there. He told us what he could, because he was talking to friends of ours, and he said he was in the Royal Navy during the war, and I looked at him thinking he had really lost it. I said, "You were in the Air Force. You always came home in Air Force uniform." He said, "I had to. Nobody could know." And he said, "My parents never, ever knew."
That's incredible.
They died before he could give the 25 years.
They're really strict. The Brits are really strict about that.
Thank you. We're coming down to you, ma'am.
Yes, I have a question. I understand. I have a friend that grew up in London, Rushton, Northants.
I'm sorry, you
she lived in Rushden, Northlands, mm-hmm. north of London. Mm-hmm. And I understand not only from her but from history that during the war, the children were moved out of London up, not up to where she was. She doesn't remember them coming up as far as she was. But I wondered who actually promoted that. Was it the Churchill family, knowing the women were very strong Churchill women? Or was it the government that actually took the notice and said, we've got to get these children
out of here? About the evacuation?
Yes.
It was the government. The decision was made in 1939 you know, the British were afraid not only that they were going to get bombed, but that they were going to get invaded. But they were very worried about bombing when the war began. And so on the first day of the war, Britain declared war on Germany September 3rd, 1939. And the day before and that day, hundreds of thousands of, or tens of thousands of children were evacuated from London and other major cities. And it was quite chaotic. The Chamberlain government had not done a very good job in preparing for this, and so these kids were put on trains, and their parents had no idea where they were going. They were not told where they were going, and no idea when they were going to see them again. And can you imagine how? I can't imagine doing that. But anyway, tens of thousands of children were sent mostly to the countryside and certainly to the north of England to get them out of what was considered very perilous territory. And, you know, there was between September 39 and August 1940 was almost a year, and that's when the real bombing began in August, September 1940. And so most of the children actually came back home before then because the parents... It worked well in some ways. It did not work well in others. I mean, you had these city kids, many of them very, very poor, many of them who had never, you know, slept in a real bed, being boarded at, you know, in rural areas. And there was a real clash, real city, rural clash. And some of these kids were actually taken to places like, I don't think the Churchill family had them, but certainly Lord Beaverbrook and some of the big, you know, the wealthy who had big country houses, they had kids staying, and it was a real difficult situation, you know, for many. So by the ironic thing is when the bombing really did begin, most of the kids were back home in London. And actually probably, I mean, many, many people died, but I think the families were not going to send them away again, even with the bombing.
That's great talk. On a more mundane footnote, could you tell us a little more about Rivington's career? You know, he spoke here, I believe.
Rivington?
Yeah.
Rivington Wyman. He became, I'm not sure what he did before. I don't know really all that much about it. He became the treasurer of the United Nations. Isn't that right? Bob probably knows much more about him than I do. And it was very, very, very much involved in the FDR, is the institute here, was on the board, I believe. He was very young when his father died and had not known him very much. His father had been very involved in government from the time he was born. He was only, I think he was 20 when his father died. And he had been sent to prep school before that. And when his father was sent to Great Britain as the ambassador, he was, I believe, at Deerfield. I'm not exactly sure, but he was at a prep school. And he left, and he joined the Marines. And his father almost had a heart attack and sent a friend to try to talk him out of it. And Rivington would not be talked. I think he was 17, certainly 18 maybe, but he did go into the Marines. So he was fighting in the Pacific, this young kid, while Wynand's other son, his older son, John Gilbert Jr., had dropped out of Princeton and had become a pilot and was part of the 8th Air Force. He was a bomber pilot. And on about his sixth mission, on a bombing raid over to Germany, he was coming back. His plane was coming back, and he was over France, and his plane was shot down.
and this was in 1943, I believe. And for several weeks, Gil Winant did not know if his elder son were alive or dead. People had said that they thought they had seen parachutes from this plane, but he didn't know. And he eventually found out that Gil Winant, his son, John Winant, was alive, but a prisoner of war. But at the same time, he found out that he was part of a group called the Prominente, who were VIP prisoners of war, German prisoners of war. And most of them were relatives of famous people. John Winant was the only American in this group. But there were the nephew of the Queen was one of them. The nephew of Winston Churchill was another. And there were about 20, 30 of these young men who were basically held together, and they were regarded as hostages. And the idea being that if things started going badly for Germany, which it did almost immediately, that they would be used as hostages and probably would be executed at the end of the war if all things else failed. And in fact, so Gil Winant, the ambassador, knew all this. He had been told all this, so he had to live with that for the rest of the war. And in fact, toward the end, in April, May 1945, I think it was Himmler, in fact, tried to do that. He ordered the execution of these young men. Thank God the officer in charge of them knew it was obvious that Germany was going to lose. He knew what would happen to him if, in fact, he did what Himmler had ordered him to do. So he turned them over to the Red Cross in Switzerland. And just a few days after the war, Gil Winant finally learned that his son had survived.
Well, just a comment. My mother lived in Halifax during the war, children from London were also evacuated to Canada.
Yes.
And she had a friend that she kept for the rest of her life who lived part of the war in my mother's house in Halifax. I was just offering as a fellow historian to let people know that they do have a 30-year rule in the UK, which is very consistent with our guest's revelation of 1975. The records,
yes.
The vast majority of the records were actually released in the mid-1970s on a 30-year rule going forward. They are much more strict about intelligence, but a huge amount of the records of the war are open. I've looked at classified materials, and most of the time it has to do with family members, and there's family sensitivities more than sort of state secret sensitivities often. 30 years is the standard rule in the UK.
And in fact, they are releasing some intelligence stuff even as we speak.
Yeah, they
right?
actually
Especially
have.
MI5 has been releasing.
Yeah, Bob may have more up-to-date information than I do, but the old system was 30 years, 50 years, and 75 years. And I they release this stuff when it's 50 years and 75. Some of it is regarded as kind of more sensitive than others. And I remember being in the archives and being very excited about seeing something that was open. And of course, all it was a bunch of gossip.
But have you? This is just a this is a historian question. But there have been times when, and again, I haven't done that much. But have you ever been disappointed in not finding things that really should be there that are open under the
yes,
under
and,
the rule,
and
they're not
very,
there?
The British archives, Bob, the FDR Library archives are incredibly wonderful, and the staff here is wonderful, but the Public Records Office is extremely well organized, and
yeah.
Of course, when something's missing, they put a piece of paper in there to tell you it's missing, which makes it even more frustrating.
More frustrating, right? Thank you. Thanks very much.